You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are. Live with all your faults. I want to wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all. So why don't you smile?
Alright, if it's Tuesday, it means we're talking to Grant Newsham. I don't even know where Grant is today. Maybe a swag and say Taiwan again. How are you, Grant?
Fine, thanks, but that's where I am. Again.
You're so. Getting, you must be getting very wealthy in Taiwan, yes?
Huh? No. That's a good one. It's sort of a low cost, low salary kind of place.
Low cost, hiding out from the Yakuza that you've written about extensively in Japan? Is that what's going on here? You're on the down low? You're not really sharing that information too much, but that's what you're doing down in Taiwan?
No. I'm just doing some research. That's all.
Got it. Speaking of Japan, to their great humiliation, stories continue to be written again about Mr. How do you say that guy's name? Gosen?
Oh, Gon.
Gon. Mm-hmm. Did we ever get to the bottom of that? What was, is there anything new on how that guy escaped from deep lockdown in Japan to get to Lebanon?
It seems as though, like the initial reports were actually, seemed to be kind of correct, that a couple of sort of Americans, at least, sort of slipped him out of the country. Via private jet, via Osaka, maybe, and he might have been, it was initially reported, in a, what do you call it, in a, like a music instrument case.
That
may have been what actually happened, you know, whether or not, you know, he kind of got a wink and a nod from officialdom, I don't know. Sometimes Japanese security is kind of lax. So it's not clear, but it does seem that maybe how he slipped out of the country and then went via Turkey and ended up in Lebanon.
All right. So nothing new to report on that front?
Not really. The Japanese are government, parts of it, particularly the prosecutors, are just madder than hornets. And they've gone after like his lawyer. They've raided one of his lawyer's offices and attorney-client privilege be damned. They've put these sort of red notices with Interpol against the Americans who helped him escape. And I don't know where those guys are. They presumably got paid very well to help him. And I think they're complaining to the Americans to sort of help, which is ironic since the Japanese almost never help the Americans when they have a similar request. They don't help anybody. It was about 18 years ago or so, the Peruvians came to Tokyo asking for the return of the former prime minister who was of Japanese origins and was sort of hiding out here. And they wanted him because he had sort of stolen a lot of money, but that's comes of being the president of Peru.
One would think. Wait, is it Fujimoro?
Fujimori, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Alberto Fujimori. And the Japanese just basically told the Peruvians to get lost. Worse than that. They were no help at all. So when Japan gets, you know, they're like a lot of people are kind of narcissists. They when they need something, they whine good and loud. And they're whining good and loud to sort of a few people these days to try and get Gon back. And I think that it's like about a six-year-old when he gets angry. It tends to consume him and it's all he can think about. So they definitely want Gon back. and the guys who helped him, so they could hold a sort of a ritual humiliation followed by a ritual execution, no doubt. But they just ought to let it go. You know, there's some things that, as you're running a country, you have to just bite your tongue and realize you've got more important things to worry about, like an economy that shrunk by 6% in recent months. But they won't. You know, they just can't help themselves. So, but it's a little bit on the back burner because of this virus business coming out of China and the government's questionable handling of it in the early stages.
All right. Next subject on things Japanese. just here in the last month, off the coast of California, Exercise Iron Fist was going on. Still might be going on for all I know, because I know there's a lot of different events that go on with that. And then, but also simultaneously, the 31st Mew's been in action with Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Forces. And I saw those headlines and I thought, wow, you know, who would have thunk, you know, that, I mean, at one time Iron Fist was, you know, never broke squelch, never got on anybody's radar. And now not only is it a big deal, right, it's noticed around the world. And now we actually had two amphibious exercises going on with the Japanese at the same time. Do you feel your pulse quicken when you even hear that discussed? Or what are your thoughts on that? That's I mean, for those people who've watched this grow over the years, that's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, if you look back a decade, in Japan, you could not even say the word amphibious. People would get the vapors, would just go berserk. And Japanese people, military, civilian, etc., couldn't use the word because it was associated with sort of invading other countries, conjured up an image of Iwo Jima. And now, 10 years later, it's sort of no big deal. And even in Japan, it's accepted as a necessary capability. But there's, and it's good to see the Iron Fist exercise. And I'll put in a plug for a guy who kept that exercise going for a number of years when nobody was interested. And it's a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel James Whitlatch. And so he's never gotten the credit he deserved, but he almost single-handedly kept Iron Fist together and going. And now it's really taken on a life of its own. And so he's never got the credit that he deserves, but it's a wonderful job. There's also what you mentioned, two exercises. And I think the other one you're referring to is a small sort of landing exercise that was done recently on Okinawa. And the significance of that really is that it was done on Okinawa, because generally the, you know, that's been considered just too sensitive, which it isn't. It may take a little effort to and absorb a little criticism from the local professional people who criticize. So that took place too. But I tend to look at these exercises now as, you know, they're good. But you look at them almost in a sense, okay, now what? Is it just sort of a repetition or something slightly more advanced than the last one? You know, is it moving farther? Is it continuing to move farther along to improve Japanese capabilities and their ability to work with us? And that's always the question. And that's, I think, a fair question, and one would sometimes like to see them move a little faster.
But it's been amazing to watch. Jay Whitlatch and I are friends. We served together. He was an instructor at the basic school.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Jay and I are friends, and then I think he's actually serving in Okinawa right now.
Oh, I didn't know. If he is, I didn't know. I thought he was still in Southern California.
I think he took a job in Okinawa, if I'm not mistaken. So so maybe you'll see him maybe your paths will cross at some point.
He did a lot of good work, so I would expect him to do it in Okinawa, if not Southern California.
Yeah. The before we talk, I want to talk about the coronavirus and just get your observations about something that's constantly in our news. But before I do that, what do you make of Mr. Kim vanishing from the planet? He had a Christmas surprise in store for we Americans, and then that did not materialize. And he's kind of been quiet. Now, do you have any sense of what drives his meter? Is it the Chinese telling him, hey, you know what, we really don't need you running amok right now, so why don't you just, go ride a horse or do something constructive, like build more bunkers or something like that? What do you make of his quiet, demeanor these days? And is China being Geppetto on Pinocchio up there on the Korean Peninsula?
I think it's probably some of each, is that when the Americans didn't respond as he expected them to do, they pretty much ignored him.
Right.
That it threw him off, because it's sort of like a dance almost. And when the other side, it doesn't respond, you don't quite know, well, what's your next dance step? And I don't think he really had any idea what to do at that point. And there may have also been, I think there was also a concern, well, if they're not going to respond as they usually do, which is to give me something, I agree to talk, or give me oil or money or sanctions relief, etc., then maybe they actually might hurt me if I do something. And I think there's it's not really unpredictability. It's the Trump administration's refusal to behave like Americans always have behaved that threw him back a bit. But also, I would certainly imagine the Chinese have something to do about his standing down a bit, because they've got enough problems going along. And I think they knew about the virus that was coming. I think they knew about it probably in early December. And they don't need problems with North Korea while this is going on. And vice versa, I don't think Kim wants to get them too angry or miffed, really, with him. So there's several things at work. The timing wasn't right for Kim. But he's not going to – it isn't not going to change his behavior or reform. He'll keep pushing. And when the time is right, we'll see some sort of poke in the eye or something that we don't like. But that will definitely be coming. And what you see with North Korea is a sort of continuous – steady sort of advance, or maybe not steady, but at least definitely progress in their nuclear weapons capability, particularly miniaturization, and also their launch capabilities. So it's really just, as I think we've noted before, an engineering problem. And as they reply it with time and resources, they'll get missiles that go farther, more accurately, and nuclear weapons they can put on top of them. And there's also, they're appear to be working on submarine-launched missiles, and that is an even bigger concern.
What about? It's been interesting to watch as he's kind of vanished from the stage for a little bit. But as you said, we know. I think we can predict safely that at some point he will reemerge, and we will talk about that more then. Give me the you just alluded to the coronavirus that the Chinese probably knew about it in early December. You certainly have a different view of it being in Taiwan than we do here in the States. Give us your view of the incidents surrounding the coronavirus.
It's funny, even being pretty close to it, I don't have a huge sense. You don't really notice panic in this. You don't see any panic or people pulling their hair out. You see a lot of face masks.
Right.
The Taiwan government has, in fact, ordered the military to send troops to go work in mask factories. And the military actually complains, we'll do it, but because it's what we're told to do. but they're apparently being asked to work the night shift instead of the civilians. And, you know, so it's insult to injury in a way. The government is very concerned about it. They've pretty much shut off the travel of individual and even groups of Chinese from or into Taiwan. They haven't completely shut off the border, but it's pretty darn tight. And you know that they are being careful. You know, any suspected sort of case of the disease, they track it down very quickly and try to figure out what the story is. And there was one fellow who just passed away sort of in Taiwan from it. There's not the panic that that one might imagine. But it's, I think, in the back of people's minds. But it doesn't seem to have, you know, hit the ground and, you know, just upset things, to my way of thinking. But it is something that, you know, everybody's interested in it, and not least what's going to happen in China with it, because they have anything the Chinese government says is just completely unreliable. Not that that's a surprise, but when it comes to this disease or the virus, you know, it's even, you know, it's more immediate and it's more of a problem. And one suspects that the scale of it is much, much bigger than has been certainly officially announced, but even more than has kind of leaked out, that it's a bigger concern. And, you know, nobody quite knows what the effect will be. And the longer it goes on, beyond just the number of people who get sick, there's the economic effects that I think those we should start seeing worldwide within a couple weeks, I would imagine.
Yeah, Apple announced yesterday they would not hit their quarterly forecast. So companies that have kind of thrown in with the Chinese are going to probably, I would think, take huge hits or big hits relative to revenue. And the question is, how long does this thing go? As you look at the various impacts that this will have on China, what do you see, Grant? How do you see this impacting China in a way that it doesn't impact the rest of the world?
Unless it goes on a long time and he causes a lot more damage in China, I don't think it really poses a threat to Chinese Communist Party control of the country. That's my sense. There's been some talk that this is the quote Chernobyl incident, referring to the Russian nuclear disaster in the 80s that played a role in bringing down the Communist Party. But I don't quite see that unless it, you know, say really gets a lot, lot worse and for a lot, lot longer. But I think one of the things it's doing is it is convincing or maybe showing a lot of Americans and Westerners and others who should have known better that they've put too many eggs into the Chinese basket. They've gotten too dependent on China, both as a market or a source of products or parts for whatever it is you're making. So it's this dependence which isn't safe, and it's like a bad marriage in a way, where I think there was a movie called War of the Roses some years back, and it's like the unhappy spouse reckons they have no choice but to put up with the abuse, which is what foreign companies get in China, for whatever reason. And now I think this the outbreak of this virus in Wuhan is in China is, I think, showing a lot of people that, you know, we don't really need China as much as we thought we did. And once this thing blows over, as it probably will, I wouldn't be surprised to see a lot of companies not go back to their Chinese sources. I think there will be a lot of companies who actually rethink either investing in China or the scale of it, and sort of realize that they can live without it. And that may be one of the most interesting effects of it, because any diminution or reduction in foreign investment, foreign capital going into China, as we've talked about on the before, is that sort of starves the Chinese Communist Party, the regime, of the necessary foreign currency that it must have. So China can either have, a military that can scare everybody on Earth, despite China facing no enemies, or it can have a world-class medical system that can take care of all 1.4 billion Chinese. It's going to have to make some choices. And so that's maybe a couple of the fallout, some of the fallout of this virus. But I don't see any, at the moment, any threat to Xi Jinping's rule or Communist Party rule yet. But you do certainly going to be some serious economic effects in China, but also the way the world views China in terms of their economic relationship and also their, to some extent, their political relationship, because you look at the Chinese government's behavior in this whole episode, particularly where they sort of tormented the doctor who first exposed it, and he died recently. He got sick of the virus and died. So you look at their behavior and all of this, and it's not an attractive thing. Although, if there's enough money waved around, a certain type of Westerner will overlook all sorts.
I was going to say it's the bane of our existence that none of that really matters, because at the end of the day, right, it's all about the having access to their markets, the profits that can come the way of your company. And also, if you're a government, right, that raises all of your bars and for your economy, and it's certainly things we want. So at the end of the day, I mean, I think what we've seen heretofore is that the economic blackmail, trumps all. No pun intended.
That is true. But I would suggest that there's more to say, quote, America or the West than Wall Street and, say, Boeing and Apple and Walmart. So there's other people, other constituencies, which are having their eyes opened a little more about the nature of the Chinese regime. And I think that is, a positive effect. It makes it a little harder for the apologists as well to apologize for what the Chinese the nature of that regime.
Yeah, when they don't do a whole lot to hide it, it is kind of disgusting to watch it out there in the open. I want to ask you kind of a tangentially related question to this, and that is evidently the President of the United States had a very, very frank and unfriendly call with the Prime Minister of Great Britain about Huawei and 5G. Somebody sent me an email and said, hey, Mac, the next time you have Grant come on, could you ask him to explain what we don't understand? Why would the Europeans even come anywhere close to having Huawei be involved in 5G infrastructure? Is it simply the extortion that the Chinese lay out there? If you want to continue to do business, we need to be a part of this. Because it seems apparent to everybody that, I read about a month ago, this is akin to having the Russians put in your phone system.
There's not much I can add. It is akin to having the Russians put in your phone system. Email or whatever messaging that people use these days, there's that abbreviation WTF. That really is about the best explanation for what the British are doing. Is that you just can hardly believe it. It's so stupid and ultimately it tracks back to a desire for Chinese money. And this has been something which British administrations, both conservative and Labour, have been after for decades. And particularly in the last 20 years, it's really gotten pretty bad to the point where you have really the country that took on Hitler alone and gave him a bloody nose is now, they've got a bloody forehead from bowing on the ground before before the Chinese Communist Party. It's a different Britain than you and I would have grown up with. And it is about that brazen. One excellent example is a recent prime minister, David Cameron,
right.
As soon as he was out of office, he started up an investment fund to get into the invest in China. And when he was prime minister as well, he was, you know, appeasing China as well. He gave the Chinese, sort of an equivalent of a state visit. And so Xi Jinping comes in and meets the queen, gets a ride in her carriage. And this is the country that has concentration camps and disappears people who disagree with what the regime says. But Britain's always, they've been like this. So it's, the Chinese investment in the British steel industry, and now they're talking about building a high-speed railway for the British. It's as if there's no other money on earth except Chinese money. But when you break it down even further, you find that you can actually identify the specific people, the number of people who get a cut of all of this. And it's ultimately accumulated effect of a lot of individuals reckoning that they're going to do quite nicely for themselves from whatever Chinese money comes into Britain. But to overlook the security aspects of this is so dumb that it really raises some very serious doubts about the motivations of the people doing it. You know, think, for example, if suppose China let the British build their, get into their communication system or the way that they're letting the Chinese do it. Do you think that there aren't, say, British guys who couldn't figure out how to take advantage of that? Of course there are, just as the Americans could. That's always been the game. But to ignore this, and particularly to just really blow off the U.S. president, was probably not wasn't a good thing, and it wasn't all that surprising. But nonetheless, for somebody say my age, it is a little jarring. But just one more reminder that the British of 1940 are not the United Kingdom of today.
Yeah, again, I was hoping there was a more complex and nuanced answer to that, because you sit here and it's an absolute head scratcher when you hear some of the comments, and you're thinking, it just doesn't, it doesn't make any sense. And then you hear, the American administration saying that that the UK would be, would be removed from the Five Eyes.
Yeah, whether that happens or not, I don't know. But you just have to look at things differently one of your closest allies does something like this. Going back to trying to understand it, if you think about, look at the effect it has on any U.S. administration. Say when a company like Apple, complains about something, you will notice, say they, want to sell into China or whatever it is they're complaining about, that you will find administrations sort of bend over in the wrong direction. But they'll actually be generally give these companies what they want. So it's not – Britain isn't the only country like this, but at some point there's a limit. And I think given the current situation, I think Britain has really made the wrong decision. I could see the Americans having done something like this actually during Obama and Bush and Clinton administrations. You could easily see that, because Huawei didn't become a threat like yesterday or even 2 years ago. It was at least 15 years ago. It was well known what the threat was from Huawei, and yet no administration took it on. So, I'm hard on the British. And there's more to it than just Huawei. That we've discussed a number of times, that our own sort of industry, business, financial world, and successive administrations have been about as craven as the current British administration is when it comes to dealing with China.
The the next thing that's been in the news very prominently the last week has been your friend, Mr. Duterte, and his delivering notice to the United States that that a security agreement, I believe the status of forces agreement, yes, that allows Americans to train in the Philippines will be rescinded. Is this playing reindeer games and this will ultimately get figured out, or is he intent on terminating that? What does your crystal ball say?
The short answer is my friend Mr. Duterte hasn't told me, but as soon as he does, I'll let you know.
Thank you.
It's kind of this, hair pulling sort of behavior on his part, but it's what you expect. He's serious, yeah, I think.
Now I read Grant, where this was precipitated by the United States not granting a visa to one of his friends, who we believe has too much involvement in kind of the murder of drug dealers in the Philippines. And so I don't know how we selectively apply our moral conscience to the visa program, but evidently he took great umbrage with that.
Yeah, that's what it said, that this is what sent him over the edge. But he's always been like this, and been threatening to, you know, cut ties with the Americans, get closer to China. He's been very, you know, this no shortage of examples since he took over of where he's threatened to do this, where he's, you know, sort of placated China. And it's been said for years, even back when he was governor down south, that he was taking Chinese money. I mean, this is like kind of everybody knows this. But that's part of the thing. But he's just he used the word mercurial for somebody who's kind of seems nuts. In a way, you know, sort of loud and brash and talks a big game. Remember, he was going to be on the jet ski to go out and challenge the Chinese who were occupying Chinese Philippine maritime territory. But there's a lot of talk there. But this is Duterte being Duterte. This shouldn't be a great surprise, I think, that it's come to this. And, yeah, I have heard that it was owing to a couple of his friends not getting visas for their role in the sort of the drug war.
Right.
But we'll see how this plays out, you know, because it is significant that, it looks as though, say, the Balikatan exercise that's coming up seems to be on track. And,
right.
And also the Philippines still has pretty good relations with Japan, with Australia, security relations. And as I say, there's also within the Philippines a lot of people who don't think what Duterte has ordered is a good thing. But nonetheless, one does need to take it seriously. And sometimes once you sort of break the glass, you can't really put it back together. And I'm not sure exactly what how this will play out. And Duterte still has some time to go in office. And, so I'm not sure about this. Some people claim that this will sort of create an opening for China if, we go ahead and terminate the VFA, the Visiting Forces Agreement, which is the SOFA, basically.
Right.
But I would suggest that China's already had a pretty good in into the Philippines since Duterte took over. We'll see. What comes of this? It's almost epic, potentially epic making. If as you recall, when we were could not reach a deal about Subic Bay and Clark Air Base back in the late 80s, and that was partly the Americans being too stubborn, but probably even more was the Filipinos trying to squeeze too much out of the Americans. And then you had some of the personalities involved in those negotiations, and that just ensured it was going to fail. And so it's a good reminder here of the importance of personality in foreign affairs. And if it wasn't Duterte, that I don't think we'd be in this situation. But it's also worth remembering, what it is that really soured some of the Philippine leadership on the Americans and our reliability in particular. And that was in 2012 when the Chinese Coast Guard, backed by the Navy, came down and basically occupied sort of a piece of maritime territory called Scarborough Shoal. Mm-hmm. The Philippines sent out their one little boat, one little Coast Guard boat, and it was obviously overmatched. And the Americans then, you know, cut a deal, you know, where both sides, the Chinese and the Philippines, both agreed they would pull back. The Philippines pulled back. The Chinese did not. The American State Department, particularly a guy named Kurt Campbell, did nothing. And the Chinese have had Scarborough Shoal ever since. And that was probably as the biggest strategic mistake the Americans have made in Asia since they were driven out of Saigon in 1975. But that really, say, soured a lot of, say, the Filipino leadership on the Americans. And Duterte has used that incident repeatedly to say, oh, these American good-for-nothings, you can't count on them. But it's always worth stepping back a little bit farther to see why we are where we are today. But this one, you know, we'll see how it plays out. But it, if not handled right, that, you know, it is easy to see us having a sort of a lot less close relationship with the Philippines than we've had. So it's once again potentially epoch making, and one hesitates to use that expression because it's used a lot. But this one does get one's attention.
Well, one of the things that I thought was most interesting about it was the fact that when they were having problems in what province were they?
Well, down in Mindanao.
Mindanao, mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. I mean, it was American aviation assets, American special forces went down there and helped them. And so to me, we can all play. I mean, this is very reminiscent of, you know, of the Obama administration and the weakness it showed in the face of Chinese aggression. But then there's things that are real. And I say that because I copy one of the things I saw last week was a number of Filipino from their parliament. They said essentially, hey, we're not good with this. We don't want the Americans to go anywhere. And so I thought, you know, I thought that was really interesting. Like, okay, we know we have some issues that we need to talk to you. We know we have some issues that we need to talk about. But let's everybody just keep our shirt on right here. And so I thought that was, you know, you talked about Mr. Duterte overplaying his hand on occasion. So I don't know. It just seemed to me that you had, you know, cooler heads attempting to prevail. But if you were a betting man, what would you bet?
I'd probably bet on both. I'd bet on both outcomes. I might bet a little more on this somehow working out, so that we don't, it is not a permanent, irretrievable rupture, but that somehow we, as I say, it's finessed, where the VFA, the SOFA agreement, it's. Oh, the termination is put on hold. You know, it's terminated, but provisionally.
Right.
And the Americans continue to keep doing stuff in the Philippines. I think that may be a way to work it out. You know, and as you pointed out, within the Philippine sort of that ruling class, there's a large constituency that is very sort of strongly committed to the United States, that sees America really as being the desired and the necessary defender of the Philippines. And the you do note that the what is he, like, foreign minister? I forget. The guy named Teddy Loxin, you know, who he's as really pro-American as I my recollection. And he's the, yet when Duterte's finally said, okay, terminate the agreement, you know, he said, okay, we'll do it. But as you noted, let's see how this plays out. You know, I say there probably is a way to finesse it if both, if neither, particularly if the Americans just show some patience. And I think we know, you know, I think we know that that's what we need to do. But we'll see how, just how much Duterte wants to make a, how much of a deal, he wants to make of this and see it all the way through. And I have a feeling that if he were to demand that, say, the Americans have nothing to do with the Philippines, I have a feeling he might be taking up lodging somewhere else besides the Philippine presidential palace. So there's maybe a limit to what Duterte can get away with here. But we'll see. But it's an unhelpful sort of distraction. But it's nonetheless, it is what comes of Duterte having won the election and having partly won the election because of the U.S.'s failure to defend a treaty ally. But we'll see.
The do you have any, do you monitor, you kind of made a smart about Taiwanese internal politics relative to the nation. Do you have any sense of, is he still as, I mean, he rode to power as very much a populist leader with a populist mantra, a conservative populist mantra in terms of, you know, crime and the economy. Do you have any sense of the Filipino people? Have you read anything that says, are they still as enamored with him as they were?
I think he's still got a lot of support. The, you know, in spite of everything, that, you know, that's something, you know, a lot of America, us, we don't care for him, Duterte, so much, but I think a lot of Filipinos do. That's my impression from, you know, people I talk to and just read a lot. But the, you know, and one thing that it's sort of interesting is the, you know, I've got one friend, for example, who, you know, would, you know, who's, you know, has a very good understanding of defense matters and you know, sort of the, not the, the top end, but at the upper end of sort of the Philippine society, and he's, you know, made comments about, particularly about this recent incident of the two Filipino officials not being granted visas because of their role in the drug war. And he's made comments that, you know, I wish you Americans understood the drug war better. And the point being that not all Filipinos see what has happened in that effort to counter drug crime. Not all of them see that as a bad thing. And if you try to put yourself in that position, you know, may you suppose, you know, if you lived in some U.S. city where crime was just out of control, you probably wouldn't complain so much about a mayor who came in and used some really harsh measures, even if there were some excesses. So from a Filipino perspective, you know, the drug war isn't sort of as bad as, you know, we Americans tend to see it. The Filipino police are, of course, completely corrupt and have had assassination squads forever. But, you know, that said, say the drug war is not, you know, actually kind of popular, I get the impression, with a lot of Filipinos, and a lot of Filipinos we think would not be, you know, supportive of it, but they are. So Duterte does have apparently a good bit of public support, but you do get an impression, though, that there's a real limit to how far he can go to placating, appeasing the Chinese. You know, there's been some, a lot of public pushback on sort of several million Chinese who've been allowed to emigrate or come into the Philippines since Duterte took power. And when he does make, when he goes too far in giving China what it wants and trying to drag the Philippines into a close relationship with China, you do see a lot of public response to that. It's not a good response from his perspective. So there are some limits on his behavior, but he does have a lot of he's got a pretty good approval rating. It's not as good as, not as high as it was, but some Americans may find him distasteful, but a lot of Filipinos do not, and in their context, in their political context and social context, that he, you know, isn't all, you know, he's not as ridiculous a president as we might sometimes be tempted to think.
The I'm going to ask you. We don't normally talk about Russia, but I'm fond of. You're an intel guy, so you're expected to have an opinion. Talking about the whole Russian influence in the Pacific Rim. We see Dr. Evil kind of roll around the world and pull off, you know, his Dr. Evil role like nobody, which leads me always to think of, it's going to be very interesting when he no longer, you know, populates the earth. What will Russian do? Who will try to pull that one off, and how will they do it? Because I don't know that anybody has all of the, all of the aura that Vladimir Putin has. What is Russia's role in the Pacific Rim?
Well, there's probably several parts to it, and they're in some ways they're distinct and also kind of contrary to each other. I think one is you have the Russians and Putin. You know, they're glad to work with the Chinese to cause the Americans trouble. So you'll see them cooperating and, say, aerial patrols,
right,
going around Japan and even ducking into South Korean territory a little bit. And the South Koreans shoot back, which they don't like much. but they're glad to do things, cooperate to the extent militarily, politically, that it causes America to consternation. It causes us, you know, to worry, and it causes our allies to worry as well, say the Japanese. So they're glad to cooperate to that extent. But then at the same time, Russia sells submarines to the Vietnamese, sells advanced air defense systems to the Vietnamese, it sells fighter jets to the Indonesians. And neither the Indonesians or the Vietnamese are great friends of China. And so they're glad to do that at the same time, which is as they are to cooperate with the Chinese. So there's an ambivalence or a sort of a paradox to Russian behavior out here. And then there's the other problem is that the old Soviet Far East, the Russian Far East out in the east, very far eastern part of Russia, is right, that China reckons Russia took it from them. And they don't say it clearly, at least not that clearly, but China reckons it belongs to China and they should get it back. I don't know what the numbers are, but there's maybe a couple million Russians in the Far East, maybe a few more, but there's like 100 million Chinese. So Mr. Putin must wonder every morning when he wakes up if he's going to find like these six cities on his side of the border, each with 10 million Chinese people in them. And that's a problem. And to me, it's a sort of a funny story. My sort of benchmark for understanding Russia and its view of China, I got it when I was in college. I studied Russian, and our professor was a nice old white Russian lady her family were refugees from the revolution. And she had grown up in Harbin in Manchuria, which was then Russian occupied, and she was actually friends with Yul Brynner. She grew up with him, and she would tell us stories all the time. And I remember about her life in China, and I always thought it was really interesting. And I remember one time that she told us about, you know, like the Chinese and her view of them. And she told the story, and I forget what that was, but I remember after she told the story, I heard her sort of murmur to herself, and she said, "Ah, the Chinese, they're like ants. There's so many of them, we could never kill them all." And to me, that pretty much said, it gave you a good sense of how Russians, how Slavs view Asians, and the Chinese in particular. So I think there's always going to be a real limit to how much Russia and China will cooperate, and just geography alone, and also Russian capabilities, put a real limit on how much they can actually do in the region. But that said, I think one shouldn't underestimate their ability to cooperate on a temporary basis with the Chinese to make life difficult for us and our friends.
All right. Now, I think the big news of the week, relative to where you're at right now, Taiwan, is Chinese aircraft buzzing Taiwanese airspace. Is that just we're going to continue to make your life miserable and we're going to be in your face and this is just another installment of it? And what was that about?
It is what you described. But there's maybe, probably, if you look at it on a continuum, it's not a good thing. Yeah, the Chinese sent some armed bombers sort of towards Taiwan, and they went across the so-called center line in the Taiwan Strait, and that's a no-no. It's not something that they should do. It's not the first time they've done it in recent years or months, even. But it's a provocative move. It's designed to intimidate and frighten Taiwan. And you'll notice that they did it even while they're facing this virus, the health threat in China, which is ravaging their economy. It's killing their citizens. They've locked down a good chunk of the country so people can't move. And yet they're still willing to engage in these military operations designed to threaten their neighbors. That gives you a pretty good sense of Chinese priorities. And I say, as noted, I look at this as one step in the gradual improvement of Chinese capabilities, and also they're sort of psychologically preparing themselves to have a go at Taiwan at some point, maybe within this decade. But it is a troubling thing, particularly if you play it out. It's part of a continuum. We've seen them doing things like this before, but it's a reminder that despite domestic problems, or maybe because of domestic problems, that China is no less committed to subjecting Taiwan to tyranny, one way or the other, either just wear them down to where Taiwan gives up, or if necessary, use force. And that's the problem that we have to deal with and make sure that that doesn't happen.
It just seems like like harassment is like camouflage and concealment, right? It's constant, and the Chinese just constantly play that game with I'm still astounded. I'm thinking about the BBC interviewer that I asked you about last time that somehow or other found a way to blame this on, the Taiwanese, like they had somehow or other provoked it because they will not play the emperor's new clothes with the Japanese. And so I just find it, I find it interesting, the way this all kind of plays out and what Taiwan has to deal with is everybody decides that, yeah, we all know it's bullshit, but what are we going to do? Stand up to the Chinese? Come on. What are we, crazy? We need their money. And so it's a wicked and tangled web that gets woven out there in the Western Pacific. And at the center of it all is the desire to sell into China, both the political reality that goes with raising your economy and what that means for your political party, as well as the money that goes with that as well. So it's kind of a tangled web, and it's kind of disgusting also in its own way. To go back to your comments about Huawei, and the Brits. I mean, come on, like there isn't other. Telecommunications companies in the UK that couldn't do this and couldn't use the business. I don't get it. So,
oh yeah, you listen. In fact, you listen to what the excuse the British give is that it would take us a year longer to roll out 5G. You mean a year? Is that all? It's not like 20 years. It's not that long, and the amount of money isn't all that great. I would put in a good word for the this administration, the Trump administration, particularly Secretary of State Pompeo and Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense Esper, have actually been very good recently, given some excellent speeches, really laying down the American position against the sort of the threat from aggressive fascist Chinese expansionism. And this is the first time in ever that an administration has finally done this. And sometimes when you know, with these kind of seminal statements, it may indicate a sort of a fundamental shift in our thinking, despite the sort of the quislings, the business communities, a lot of it in financial world being willing to give in. But when an administration is willing to say play rough, it can have an effect, and we'll see how it goes. So it's not unremitting disaster, and we've got, if we keep it up, we've at least got a chance.
Well, it's that whole thing, standing up on your hind legs, as you pointed out to us, is it comes with some tangible benefits. So we'll see if we can continue to keep it up. Anything that I haven't asked you about things in the Pacific Rim that you would be remiss without leaving about discussing or mentioning?
I'll think of it as soon as I hang up. I think we've got a good bit of it. One thing I've been reading about the Japanese government response to the virus, and what it reminds me of is the after the nuclear disaster in 2011, when the nuclear plant up in Fukushima got hit by the tsunami and put out of operation, that the Japanese government actually pretended there was nothing wrong. And they refused to let foreign experts come in. They refused to release information other than saying there was nothing wrong. And they've done kind of the same thing about the Chinese virus. And it's partly because they don't want the business class doesn't want to upset China. And also Abe and his sort of pro-Chinese advisors want to make sure that that Xi Jinping comes to visit Tokyo in April, so they didn't want to get the Chinese mad. And thus they let about 500,000 Chinese come into Japan while the virus, after it had broken out, come in as tourists without any control. And that's gotten some parts of the Japanese society up in arms. But it's been very interesting to see how the regime, the government here in Japan has actually responded to the virus threat. And it's almost true to form is one way to put it. I just throw that out because I had noticed, but found it very both interesting, but also familiar, having gone through the nuclear incident in 2011. But that's the only thing I would note.
All right, let me ask you a history question. I was having a discussion with my daughter, who's in high school, who was having to argue that the ends justify the means. How do the Japanese look at the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki? I mean, my daughter and I were talking, and I said, you could make the case that was the vastly less of two very, very unpleasant courses of action. The second one being the invasion of mainland Japan and the casualty estimates that were done by American planners that had American casualties to up to 4 million and Japanese casualties over 10 million. How do the Japanese look at that?
Like a lot of things, when you say the Japanese, it's which ones are you talking about? Okay. But that said, to me, the way I've tended to look at this is the average Japanese knows what they learn in school. And they have been taught that to the extent they're even taught about World War II, and it's really skimmed over, they've been taught that Japan was, it's like out of the blue one day, some American airplanes came over, dropped bombs, and destroyed these two cities. Just out of the blue. And it's almost the impression you would get. So they, you know, there's a sense of victimization that Japan has, it was kind of a victim, and you know, bad things happened, et cetera, et cetera. So there's not much sort of introspection about the events that led up to that, or what would have happened if they had not been dropped. But it's not to the social extent the average person thinks about it. The topic, that's kind of how it is. But at the ruling class level, say say Prime Minister Abe's in that slice of Japanese society, they see it as just a war crime that really unfairly targeted Japan, murdered Japanese. Just there's absolutely no excuse for what the Americans did. And then they will take it a little even further and say, well, yeah, you know, we, you know, it was World War II, it was the war, and both sides did bad things. And they tend to think that those two bombs actually even the ledger, that evened it, balanced things out, that anything Japan might have done, you know, the human experiments in China, you know, plague warfare, you know, murdering prisoners and helpless civilians on an industrial scale, that was because the Americans dropped those bombs, we're all even. Let's forget about all of that. And they have tended to use those as an excuse for Japanese behavior during the 30s and 40s. So it's not a, you know, it's a topic that, you know, I suppose as time goes on, we'll sort of forget about it. But if it's something that, you know, we say our generation, that we kind of think about it more, that it's not, it doesn't leave one with a very good impression of Japan's ruling class, this sense of victimization without any sense of what it was, why it was done, and what the alternatives were.
I have to tell you, I'm a bit surprised that in the year 2020, they still don't get more of a balanced view of their role in World War II.
Oh, not at all. It's, I say, to the extent it's even taught, it's not really taught, and there's a tendency to, in anthropologists will tell you, in Japanese psyche to want to avoid unpleasantness, and that includes thinking about unpleasantness and certainly public debates over things that are controversial. But really, guys like Abe, they reckon that Japan did a service to Asia by ridding it of the white man's yoke, and I've heard them say that. And that Japan has never been appreciated for providing that service. That's one of the reasons Japan, Abe and India, likes India so much. It'll be an unresolved issue, I think, just as if I were to go to Alabama and talk about the greatness of the Yankees or such, you know, whatever. Or Georgia and talk about General Sherman deserving a Nobel Peace Prize. But it's just something that'll never get, I don't think we'll ever resolve it.
Got it. All right, sir. First of all, Grant, always a pleasure to catch up with you. And what are you working on, and will we see it?
Oh, goodness. I'm trying to put something together about the economic effects of the virus on the Chinese regime. So it's taking a little while, but you know, we'll see. Maybe Asia Times will take it. I'll aim for that, and we'll see how that goes. It's sometimes it's hard to get the ideas together, even though they're pretty simple. But one question: did you go to Hawaii yet?
No, not yet. I'm supposed to go there at the end of March, the beginning of April.
Okay. Well, if they have a Chinatown, you know. And you can get some bat soup there if you like.
Should I go there? I thought bat soup was a Taiwanese event.
Well, they have Taiwanese people in. Uh-huh. There's a little Taiwanese office in Chinatown. So.
All right. Well, I don't know why, but I think I might pass on that. It doesn't sound like the most appetizing thing.
Okay. Then a hike up Diamond Head instead. That would be something. That's worth doing.
All right. All right, Grant. Thank you very much for the visit. Have travel safe and good luck in your riding.
Okay, thanks a lot. Talk to you later.
There you have it. That is Grant Newsham here on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.